Welcome, everyone. Really exciting to see all of you here. If I didn't get to come over personally, just know I'm very excited to see you, and I will try to catch you before you leave. But if not, thank you so much for joining today. On behalf of Mealy, on behalf of me, I'm so happy that we had such an incredible turnout. It shows the commitment of the incredible women in this community that on New Year's morning, when I can tell you when I flew in this morning, O'Hare Airport, you could have heard crickets. There was no one out. People are home. People are fast asleep. And the women of our community were up ready to be learning Torah as the first thing of 2023. So really, a round of applause to everyone in this room. I hope you have had an enjoyable morning of learning. And I hope it continues. We have our panel now with three incredible panelists who I will introduce in a moment. And then tonight, we will be having, as our concluding events of the day, at the Wi-Fi Beit Midrash, I will be speaking and would love to see you there as well. So to introduce our panel for today, when I was thinking about our theme of trending and tradition, I said, what kind of panel discussion? I think panels are great. You get to get a number of different perspectives. What can we discuss? And I said, what better to discuss than Torah learning? If there is anything that is more traditional than Torah learning, I can't think of it. From the beginning of our religion, we are the people of the book. We are learning. We are studying. But if I also think, in what area is there the most innovation happening today in the Jewish world? And I think that is also Torah learning. That there are so many incredible educators who are coming up with so many new ways of teaching Torah, of disseminating Torah, of engaging others in Torah, that I think there is so much for us to discuss, and that was definitely what we wanted to talk about today. So, to introduce our three incredible panelists, we have Mrs. Alyssa Zephrin, we have Mrs. Olivia Friedman, and we have Mrs. Beth Perkel. And instead of reading their bios, which you can do in your folders, I am going to start with having them introduce themselves. So let's start with Beth.
Sure.
Please introduce yourself.
Good afternoon, everybody. I'm Beth Perkel. I'm a professional writer, a speaker, a Magid Shir, and also an author. I'll give you a few examples of each of those pieces of my professional life. So in terms of writing, I write for publications ranging from Mishpacha Magazine, Family First, Ami Magazine, Ish.com, all the way to the Jerusalem Post, and secular audiences too, some different magazines within that. And I had a blog, very active blog on Times of Israel for a while, and that actually led into my book, which I'll speak to in a minute. In terms of my speaking, I speak to a variety of audiences, both nationally and internationally, a wide range of people of different religious backgrounds, kibbutz organizations, regular shiurim. Some of you might have heard me speak in the community before. One of my passion projects right now is I'm developing a chabura for women in their Shana Rishona. I feel that there's a lot of education we give women in kala classes, but then we sort of expect them to step under the chuppah and then be magical marriage experts. So I think that kallahs could use more support in their first year of marriage in terms of education, about relationships, communication, even just issues in adulting, right? There's sort of a failure to launch in the new generation in terms of figuring out finances and stuff like that. So after speaking to a lot of, psychology professionals, I've sort of developed the curriculum and I'm looking to launch my first chabura with that. In terms of my authorship, my first book came out, I was going to say last year, but welcome to 2023 now, 2 years ago, 2021. It's called Light at the Beginning of the Tunnel, Wiring Our Children for Happiness. And the two things, first of all, it was a real passion project because it brought four of my interests together. I have a background in psychology, my passion for Torah learning and, teaching Torah, parenting, and, of course, writing. And the book is unique in that, first of all, it approaches happiness from a whole family perspective, right? There are chapters on learning the tools for happiness yourself and also teaching them to your children. And the second piece is really that it is all presented versus all these happiness books you can find in the library. It's every concept is presented through the beautiful prism of our Masorah. So so that is my work in terms of authorship at this point.
Hi, everybody. I'm Olivia Friedman. I'm a teacher here at Ida Crown Jewish Academy. And in addition to that, I'm a blogger and I'm a podcast host and I write for various places. So a little about that. I've been blogging since I was a teenager on all sorts of topics, but mainly about figuring out how Judaism worked and what Judaism meant to me, because I was one of those people myself for whom my Jewish day school education did not work out as well as it should have. And because of that, I'm very interested in creating more access points for Jewish education and for people to connect to their Judaism. And I think that there's a lot of ways that we can create those access points. So for me in particular, my bachelor's is in English literature, and I love to read. So I read everything, you know, young adult books and fiction and so on. And when I read, I often will find connections between the things that I'm reading and Tanakh or other aspects of Judaism. And I really like to show how those things connect, which I do in my writing, whether that's on my blog or on my Facebook or in publications I've written for Tablet Magazine and The Forward and The Lear House, if any of these ring a bell. And then my newest initiative right now is that I have a podcast called Parsha for Kids, because I realized that my own kids, who are ages 2 through 8, really enjoy listening to audiobooks and to podcasts, but I couldn't really find what I was looking for in terms of Parsha podcast content. I found a lot. There's a lot available with Uncle Moishe and various tapes and so on, but I was looking for something that would really go through the whole Parsha and only bring in Midrash when it was relevant and not look at the entire thing through a lens of Midrash. So I figured that I would do that. So that's something that I've been doing. I've also been interviewed on some podcasts on topics that are of interest to me in terms of the Jewish world, particularly mental health. That's a passion of mine. And also going back to education, how we teach students who are high ability learners. This is also called gifted and talented. So I have a lot of different things that intrigue me and that I'm excited to talk to you about, and I hope this will be enjoyable for you all.
All right. Hi, I'm Alyssa Zephyrin. I'm a colleague of Olivia Friedman's at Ida Crown Jewish Academy. I teach Tanakh and Jewish history, and I also run the student activities programming here. And I'm also the director of Student to Student in Chicago, so I think we'll tell you a little bit more about that during the panel. So Student to Student is a program where we train Jewish teens from Orthodox, Reform, and conservative backgrounds to go out into Catholic schools and public schools with low to no Jewish population, low exposure to Judaism, and we give peer-to-peer presentations about Judaism, mostly from the perspective of a Jewish teen, and it gives a much bigger perspective of what Judaism looks like in America across the different branches of Judaism and how Judaism is practiced by the average American teen today, and it helps break down stereotypes that a lot of those teens come into these classrooms with, having only encountered Jews maybe in TV, in movies, literature, but having never met a real Jewish person before. So it shows them that Judaism is not a monolithic faith, and it makes it very relatable, very personal. There's a lot of experiential learning, a lot of show and tell. We bring with us props. So anytime we talk about a life cycle event, we also pass around different props to show that. We do a little sample Jewish wedding in the middle of our presentation. We have the audience shout out Mazel Tov after we stomp on an imaginary glass at the end of our wedding presentation. There's actually a little video clip. If you want to follow Student to Student on Facebook, there's a little video clip of the end of one of those sample weddings that we've done recently. We're currently in about 15 schools in the Chicagoland area where we present, and we have teens who present with our program from Ida Crown, Rochelle Zell, some of the selective enrollment public schools in Chicago, Jones College Prep, Walter Payton, and also the North Shore public schools as well, Deerfield High School, Glenbrook North, Vernon Hills, we have a presenter from Oak Park, River Forest. And so this is our fifth year running Student to Student, and our goal is to continue to grow and have a wider and wider impact. Last year we presented around 60 times, and we reached an audience of over 2,000 teens. So.
Okay. As you've heard, each of them are doing really interesting, innovative things in the world of Torah learning. So my next question is, what brought you to this area of work? So let's start with Olivia. Was this something that for all of you. Was this something that you always knew you wanted to go into Torah education? Was this something that you came to later in life? And if so, what was that switch?
All right, my life path, the plan was that I was going to go to the University of Chicago, and I was going to get a degree in English literature, and then I was going to continue it, and I was going to be a professor of English literature. So that was the plan. That was the direction it was heading. And it was interesting. I went to University of Chicago, and I went to Stern College, their honors program, and I checked out both of the programs. And I realized, I sat in on some of the classes at UChicago at the time, both the Bible classes and the humanities classes. The humanities classes were excellent. In the Bible classes, I realized that there were issues with translation. So here you had this world-renowned professor who was explaining something, and I knew the Hebrew, and I knew that the translation was not really entirely accurate to what the person was suggesting. And that bothered me because I thought, well, how is this going to work? It's not good if I know something different, or I know differently from my professor here. And those were the two that I was choosing between. Anyway, I made a deal with my parents that I was going to try out Stern. I was going to try it out for one semester, and if I absolutely hated it, I was going to transfer. So obviously that went differently from how I anticipated, and I ended up actually really enjoying Stern, and I continued there. I went to Revel, and enjoyed exploring my Judaism. But really before that, what happened was that in high school, I went to a non-Jewish high school. And so my students, I transferred there because, like I said, my Jewish experience at high school wasn't working out too well. And students would ask me, why are you doing those things? Like, why are you mumbling blessings? Or, like, why are you washing your hands for bread? And so I started to have to research into my Judaism to figure out why I was doing everything that I was doing. And there was no oversight because there was no one watching over me saying, well, you've got to do this now. Really, whatever I wanted to do in high school, I could have done. I could have worn whatever clothing I wanted. I could have eaten whatever I wanted. No one was going to tell my parents. No one was going to know either way. And so I had a choice point. And I really think that everyone at some point gets to that choice point. And maybe for some people, it's when they live away from home for the first time. Maybe for some people, that's when they go off to college. But at some point, you have to invest in this religion as something that you want to do and not only something that was passed on to you from parents and grandparents. And it depends on the person as to what degree you want to or you need to research into the religion in order to feel that investment. But I was someone who really wanted to figure out, well, why was I doing the things that I was doing? So for me, my 11th and 12th grades of high school, I kind of became the token Orthodox Jew at my school. Kind of funny. I played a student-to-student role at my school before there was student-to-student, just answering questions about what I was doing, why I was doing it, figuring out the background. And that was very helpful for me in my journey, and that was, I think, part of what pushed me to later on end up becoming a Chumash teacher. But if you had spoken to me in high school, the last thing on earth that I would have thought I would be doing would be being a Tanakh teacher.
Beth, what brought you to your line of work?
So your question was part of it, if I was always interested in it. So if you could call first grade interested in it, then yes. I had a really special, magical teacher in first grade, just showing the impact of teachers, who I turned in a 13-page story to in first grade, and she told me, you're going to be a writer. And I was in touch with this teacher over the years. She really had a very big impact on my life, and she invited her to my wedding. And when she came to my wedding, she not only brought along a traditional present, but she brought a story of mine that she'd saved all those years, which was really beautiful, that she then gave me. So she really put the seed in me to, explore writing, develop my writing, and I really did that for many years. In high school, I decided, hey, writing is really a blessing to have a talent that you don't need necessarily graduate school for or even a college degree. So my family got Newsweek every week, and I would read it. I said, why not just submit something there? What's the worst that can happen? They could reject me, and then I'm no worse off. And I remember being really nervous to submit my first piece of writing to a real magazine. And I gave it to my friend on the way to the academy. We were driving. And she just kind of like at a stoplight threw it in the mailbox. I didn't even know if it got in. But then I received a call from them a few weeks later. They were going to publish it. I remember calling from the academy payphone to edit it with them. Kind of dates, how you can tell how old I am. But that was really my sort of foray into the writing world. Then when I was 18, I won my first writing award. When I was 19, I continued to submit, and I had my first story published in the New York Times bestselling book. So really snowballed from there. In college, I went to the University of Pennsylvania. And I was given like a beat on the newspaper there where that I covered all the everything that came into that department. And the University of Pennsylvania had fascinating people come, Kevin Spacey, famous rappers. But I felt like the writing I was doing about these different people like wasn't so meaningful to me. So I decided to, I really wanted to start, you know, looking into writing for the Jewish world. That summer I had an internship at the JUF News in Chicago, and they let me write a lot of pieces. They even let me write my first feature article for the magazine. And that kind of started me on the world of Jewish writing, where I felt I could share my passion of Torah and Yahadut also with this passion of writing. So that's sort of what led me on that path.
And Alyssa. All right, so I came to the role of being a Tanakh teacher first as a history teacher. I studied Jewish history undergrad, and then I thought I wanted to go into academic history, so I got a master's in modern European history, and I thought I wanted to switch to American history, so I got a master's in American history. And in the course of doing that, I started teaching American history and English at Beis Yaakov High School, and 4 years into that, I also started teaching at Ida Crown and TI, and so I spent the last 2 years of that driving from TI to Beis Yaakov High School to the Academy, and realized like after I had my second child that that wasn't sustainable.
At least the gas prices were better.
So I started teaching full time in Ida Crown about 10 years ago, and when I first came on, I was teaching Jewish history. And then an opportunity came up a year or two into that to teach Tanakh as well. And at the time, Beth Pagonitz took me under her wing and really mentored me into what it means to be a Tanakh teacher. And so I've been teaching Jewish history and Tanakh ever since. In terms of the student-to-student piece, I had an opportunity about 5 years ago to chaperone a group of teens for a national NCSYA program called JUMP. It stands for the Jewish Unity Mentoring Program. And it's a leadership conference that's run sort of like a Shark Tank. So you come and they give you a challenge and you have to innovate something within those parameters of the challenge. And you're competing against all these other Jewish day schools with your leadership initiative. So at the time, it was about 2 weeks after the shooting at the Tree of Life Synagogue in Pittsburgh. And so they restructured our leadership conference based around what can you do as teens to make an impact in the world in terms of Jewish education or Jewish advocacy. And so the teens that I was chaperoning really wanted to create something that was meaningful and that would break them out of the Jewish world bubble and try to combat anti-Semitism in a meaningful way. And as they were describing their goals and their wishes, they're like, how could we get out of Ida Crown to like do meaningful work out in the community with people who've never met Jewish teens before? And it reminded me of the student-to-student program, which has been around in St. Louis for almost 30 years. My husband participated in student-to-student as a teen growing up in St. Louis. And when I was an NCSY advisor working in the Midwest, I periodically met teens who were also from St. Louis doing student-to-student. So at the time, I didn't know if student-to-student was something that was like modular that we could bring to Chicago. So I reached out to the program director in St. Louis and said, you know, is there a way that we can bring student-to-student and run it in Chicago? And the timing was really perfect because they had just received a grant the previous year to expand to new cities, and they had started expanding to two new cities prior to when I reached out to bring it here. So it was really fortuitous timing, hashkacha pratis, as we would say, there was a model of how we could bring it here. And so that first year with that group of teens, we launched student-to-student with 30 teen presenters. From Ida Crown, and 20 from Ida Crown and 10 from other schools in the Chicagoland area. We got into 4 schools that year to present. We gave 16 presentations, reaching an estimated audience of about 400 teens. So part of why I'm so passionate about what we do in student to student is it really does feel like we're making a difference in terms of combating anti-Semitism in a really tangible and meaningful and even quantifiable way. I know there's a lot of really worthwhile programs out there that raise awareness about anti-Semitism, that teach teens to use their voice. Our program brings these teens out to spaces where they really need to hear from Jewish teens, and they need to hear what Judaism really is outside of the textbook, and it does that in a very meaningful way. I also think that it gives Jews, as Olivia was saying, she had to develop the language and the skills to speak to a non-Jewish audience about what she believes and what she practices and why she practices that way. And so that's what we do in our program. We give teens the skills and language to explain what they believe to a non-practicing audience. And sometimes there's Jews in the audiences, too, where we present. And they also hear perspectives from their co-presenters that they would otherwise never have exposure to. And it's really great to see how they work together. So sometimes, like, a question might be asked, because we take Q&A throughout the entire presentation. So sometimes there's a question about, like, Shabbat or afterlife, and you'll see some of the presenters say, you know, I'm not really sure how to answer that question. Maybe one of my co-presenters can answer that question. So they really do, like, build off of each other and build off of each other's strengths. And so, yeah, it's just a huge passion project of mine.
Incredible. This one may take it a little bit deeper, but do you think that the way that you are now teaching and sharing Torah has affected your personal relationship with Torah and the way that you learn yourself? And if so, how? Oh, I tell who we're starting with. We'll start with Alyssa.
Okay. I think as soon as I started being a Tanakh teacher, I realized how much of the learning component in my life I had missed for some of those years where I was just involved in academic history and teaching U.S. history without the Tanakh piece. I really fell in love with Tanakh learning more in seminary, and always wanted to be a lifelong learner, and teaching Tanakh gives me that outlet. Like, there's always something new to prepare, and there's always something new that I'm learning from my students. Sometimes students ask, like, don't you ever get bored teaching the same things year after year after year? And the answer is no, because the students are always different. So the questions are always different, the discussions are always different. There's new contemporary issues in the world that are always different, and it shapes the discussions that flow in the classroom as well. So definitely, being a Tanakh teacher, a Jewish history teacher, forces me to be a lifelong learner, which I love.
Beth.
Read the question again.
Yes. How do you think that the way you approach sharing Torah has affected your personal relationship with your learning and your association with Torah?
Similar to Alyssa, I'd say, even though I'm not a formal teacher in the classroom, you know, I have to do tons of research whenever I give a shiur. I love to give shiurim on things I'm passionate about. That's why I'm forming this chabura for women and their Shana Rishona. I've just seen a lot of, you know, the divorce rate be higher in the community, and people need more fundamentals. So it's really nice to, you know, share from my own experience and kind of triage between my passion, psychology, teaching, writing, and sort of bring them all together. And it does force me to do a lot more learning about the topics. I just was saying to my husband, you know, a lot of people when they give a shiur, they sometimes they'll recycle material, but I try to always give new shiurim, even when I give talks about my book. A lot of people will say, why don't you speak for our group? Do you have, like, a canned thing that you give? And I'm like, I really don't have a canned thing that I give, and part of that's because it forces me to research things and to learn more whenever we present something new.
And Olivia, and if I can give a specific, like, caveat to Olivia's, you can say whatever your answer is going to be, but also has specifically preparing the children's podcast brought you to think about the Parsha differently?
So let me start with that.
Okay.
The answer is yes. So I grew up with the Little Medrash Says, which I absolutely loved. And I actually think there's a lot of value in teaching Midrash to kids, because one of the things that the Baalei HaMidrash do is they make very clear who the hero and who the villain is. And if you look into child psychology and child development, whoever it is you want to focus on, whether you want to focus on Piaget or you want to focus on different thinkers, students, children begin with more concrete thinking, and then they develop more abstract thinking as they get older, which means it can actually be quite helpful for younger children to have somewhat a black and white view of the world or of the characters in Tanakh. But the important thing is that what you need to do is make sure that they get the nuance and they get the unpacking and they get the exposure to the fact that the version of Esav that you learned when there was a black and white version to learn when you were 5, where he was a villain and therefore he really didn't deserve those blessings, by the time you're in high school, it's important that you realize that the Esav who's depicted in the Pshat is not the same as the Esav that you learned about in Midrash. So I think when we do that well, that can actually be really effective. But I also think that sometimes, and I saw this because I grew up with it, I grew up with Little Medrash says and so on, the messages of the Midrash are intended in some ways either for a particular time or for a particular audience, and it can be concerning when they're taught to little children. So I'll give an example of one. There's one that my own son came home that he learned, which is that Dinah, who was the daughter of Yaakov, was kept in a box. And she was kept in a box because, Yaakov didn't want Esav to see her, because if Esav had seen her, then, he would have taken her to wife. And if that would have worked out, like, she would have been able to redeem him. And because Yaakov did this, this is why what ends up happening later, the kidnapping of Dinah and, of course, her rape, this happened because of that. And there's a link there. Now, we don't dismiss that out of hand. There's a lot that you can learn from that as an adult. But as a child, what they typically tell you is just Dinah was kept in a box. So what I've had to do when I prepare the Parsha podcast every week, because I'm assuming I'm talking to kids ages 7 and up, is think very carefully about what I'm going to include based on the Pshat, what I'm going to include based on Midrash, and what I'm going to deliberately not include because I don't think that the values that are going to be taught are going to be helpful in this 30-minute segment that I'm preparing. So it actually takes a lot more time than you would think, because what I end up doing is I'll read through the Parsha with Midrash, then I'll read through the Parsha with Rashi, then I'll read through the Parsha with Pshat, and then I'll figure out after I've read through all of that how I'm going to write up my write-up of what I'm going to record for kids that I think is going to give them very practical takeaways of what they can take home and apply in their own life from this Parsha. And that feeds into this bigger idea, which is that I think Judaism is very much about access and access points. And I think that everyone deserves access to Judaism, and that's why, to me, I think it's so good that we have so many different ways that Judaism is practiced. Beyond the denominations, like which to some degree is happening as student to student, where you have Orthodox and maybe Reform and Conservative and so on, and people who don't affiliate one particular way, even within Orthodoxy, you're going to have Hasidim in Borough Park, and you're going to have Modern Orthodox, and you're going to have Open Orthodox, and you're going to have a lot of different people, and not everyone's going to agree on everything, but people are searching for what's truth and what's valuable, and like for access to their Judaism. That's what people are looking for. And so when I look at my role in the school as well, at Ida Crown, so I like to teach bringing in things from the contemporary world. I like to use pop culture or use Disney movies or use books that are being read by our students as a jumping off point and show how does that interweave with the Tanakh. How is the Tanakh not only a historical document, but how is it speaking to you now? How is it addressing your humanity? And there are going to be some kids in my class for whom that's going to work very well. And there are going to be some kids in my class who would really prefer a much more traditional model of you open up the Chumash and you read the Pasuk and you read the Rashi and you learn the Parsha Nut and you move on to the next. And the good thing is that we've got both kinds of teachers or all kinds of teachers in the school. And so hopefully whatever it is that you need in terms of your access point of how you'll be able to enter the tradition, my hope is that there's enough out there, there's enough choice that you're going to find your way in.
I think we often talk about the challenges in the world of education today and how many distractions there are for kids and adults, and everybody has so much going on. So along that route, what do you find to be the biggest challenge in what you do, and what do you find to be your favorite part, if there could be like a highlight of what you do? Let's start with Beth.
I'll start with the favorite part. Baruch Hashem, I really, find it to be a zechus that, what I do professionally gives me so much chias, like life force. I have one of my favorite writers. I saw she once wrote like a little play on like the saying, run for your life. So she said she writes for her life. Like, it gives her so much just, the creative outlet means so much to her, and is so impactful that, it really is something she feels she has to do. So, like, she drinks, she eats, she writes. So I feel that way. I feel very happy that I, do something that I'm very passionate about. In terms of the challenges, so I would say as a personal challenge, in all of my writing, it was always very sort of lishma. And then when I became an author, there had to be sort of this component of becoming a salesman that I never really saw myself as such a, I never was really a salesman. So the reality is for any author nowadays, that your publisher really expects you to sell your book as much as possible. I don't happen to be someone who's on social media a lot and stuff like that, so it has really become a challenge to me to separate the Lishma aspect, which is I get so much beautiful feedback on how much the book is impacting people and how much it's helping their parenting. But, you know, every once in a while you'll hear that, like, you know, 17 people all borrowed the book from the same person, and you do sort of think to yourself, and if you want to buy a copy, you know? So that aspect has been hard for me. In my articles, it's always been they pay you a lump sum and then they sell the magazine, and I could just have the nachas of when people would talk to me about the piece and how it affected them and how it, you know, inspired them or helped their lives. Now I really have struggled with the piece of being a salesman. My book came out during COVID, which is a very difficult time to sell a book. People weren't really going to bookstores. Most of my book events, which would normally be all over the United States, we're on Zoom. It is very hard to sell a book on Zoom. So I would, you know, hopefully post the link at the end of my talk. So that's been really a sort of a challenge with my writing I've never had to have before. That being said, I do love the book. I'm passionate about it. And I am selling copies afterwards that I have here if anyone wants to buy any. But I would say that was a big challenge for me.
Okay, Olivia.
So I love for my students to be creative and to feel like they have ownership over Torah. And the thing is that in order to do that, you need foundational knowledge. It's somewhat like math, right? You cannot get to higher or more advanced mathematics if you don't know that 2 + 2 = 4. And that can be difficult, because if you enjoy reading or you enjoy learning or you're willing to sit down with a text in front of you and put in the effort to learn it, then eventually you will get to that place where you really feel ownership and you're able to compare and contrast multiple different approaches and commentaries, figure out the one that resonates with you or speaks to you, come up with a creative project. But there's that piece that comes first. And I think that it is very difficult now because there's so many things competing for everyone's attention, and it's not only students' attention, but even adult attention, parent attention, right? We could go on and on about what those things are, but it could be anything from the state of the world and how people feel about the state of the world to their phone and their social media and so on. So with so many things competing for attention, to sell my kids on the importance of, well, we really need to learn these 3 chapters, and then I'll be able to give you the creative assignment or the creative project, or you'll be able to showcase your knowledge and everything you're excited about, that is hard. And I don't think that's unique to me, though. I think that in general, teaching right now has got that tension going on, not only in Judaic studies, but in really every subject, just by virtue of where we are right now in terms of the world. And I think that we've already come up with various techniques and strategies to help students still, you know, move forward with this. And I think we're only going to get better at that, because I tend to look at all these new innovations as opportunities as opposed to things to get scared of. Like, I think there's a way to harness technology for good. And there's, you know, that's what a podcast is, right? All these people who are sharing their Torah on podcasts so that you could be sitting in a car listening to a lecture or listening to a talk. I can be washing dishes and I could be listening to a Tanakh podcast. That's amazing, right? That didn't exist before. The same with these kids. So with my Parsha podcast, for example, I've gotten feedback from people who say, hey, you know, I'm homeschooling my kids, and this is great because, you know, I put this on, I've got 30 minutes on a Friday and they learn the Parsha, or I'm on my way to school, I'm driving to school and I put this on in the car. And so that's awesome. You know, you're reaching kids potentially when they're doing something else, but they're also learning this. So I think that it is a challenge, but I also think that we can innovate and it will end up being good.
So as a classroom teacher, I'm seeing the same challenges that Olivia does, that there's just so much today that competes for our students' attention. It could be like social emotional pieces, it could be what's going on in the world, it could be technology, what's going on their iPads in the classroom.
Yeah.
But like Olivia, we try to harness the technology towards the learning process, so that it's not just there as a tool, but it's essential to the learning outcome. So I also do a lot of project-based learning in my classes, in both Tanakh and especially in Jewish history. So once we've created that foundational knowledge, they can then do something really meaningful with it. So I can give an example of something that I do at the beginning of the year in my Jewish history classes that I feel like for my students coming into Jewish history, where they might come in thinking Tanakh exists in one little disciplinary bubble, and then Jewish history exists in another disciplinary bubble. So the first project that we do is to fuse those worlds so that they can see that there's a continuum. So the first project that they do after we do like a bird's eye view of events in Tanakh from a historical perspective is they get into groups, and I assign each group a famous artifact to study from the ancient period of events that are covered in Tanakh. And then I give them also the verses in Tanakh that correspond with that artifact. So I know that there's some parents of Ida Crown students in the class, you might have seen this if you've come into my class for like open house night. So in their groups, I give them like a guided step-by-step packet so they're not going in blind to this project. But, you know, what does the artifact inscription say? What do the verses in Tanakh say about the same events? Identify similarities and differences. Read these secondary source articles or video. Watch these videos. How do we make sense of this? How do we come up with an answer to any discrepancies that we've identified between the Tanakh version and the version on the artifacts? And then at the end, they have to present their findings to their classmates. They have to analyze, well, what is the truth? And what they come out of it as, there's this almost like false dichotomy between what the artifact says, and that must be true because it's written in clay and stone, so that has to be true. What do we do with Tanakh? So at the end of the day, they come out with, you're not reading this like objective secular perspective on history from an artifact. You're reading a different sacred perspective from like priests that were authoring, scribes that were authoring these ancient artifacts, but you're reading a one perspective, and then we're reading the Tanakh's perspective. So what they get out of that is also an intro into how do you read primary sources when you're reading for what is the audience, what was the goal of the text. And so they're getting all of those important history tools through the project as well, and a deeper appreciation for the perspective that Tanakh is teaching from, and what Tanakh is not trying to do. Tanakh is not trying to be the be-all and end-all to historical inquiry. And it leads us to question the accuracy of a lot of what was written in these ancient artifacts. We know that a lot of the kings who authored these artifacts were writing not only for the public, they also would bury a copy often of some of the artifacts for the gods to read as well. And they wanted the gods to look favorably upon them. And so that really changes the way we see what ancient artifacts were supposed to accomplish in the ancient world. And then at the end of the project, they do a Google-sized presentation for their classmates, and they do an artifact replica. So they have to, using any materials they choose. So I've had students in groups who've tried to do like as accurate and detailed as possible, authentically trying to copy the original artifact. Now we have students who 3D print some of their artifact replicas. We get edible artifacts, and then they pass around their like Cyrus cylinder cookies or Code of Hammurabi cake we had this year. I've seen Lego artifact replicas. So it's combining a lot of learning modalities, and so that's exactly what Olivia was talking about, is the goal now is engagement. Our students are so pulled in so many different directions. We want to like harness that focus and get them super engaged in our learning tasks, so that they're as invested in the learning as we want them to be, as we are, but that they come away with real, tangible learning experiences in addition to the acquisition of the content.
Okay, and I'm going to ask one last question, and then I'll open it to the crowd if anyone has any last questions. So my last question is, what's next? So you are all innovating and coming up with new creative ways of sharing Torah. What's your next project? What are your goals? Where are you going with this? Let's start. I don't remember who started last. Olivia, you can start.
Okay, great. So the first goal that I had was to write a Dvar Torah, ideally an original Dvar Torah, like my own thought or content on it for every Parsha of the week, which I did. So now I have the Parsha podcast, so the goal is to have a Parsha podcast on every Parsha of the week for children, which hopefully I'll accomplish. And then if I finish both of those things, the next thing I would like to do is write a book. So we'll see if that happens, but that would be the goal.
What would your book be about?
So the thing is, there's so many things I'm interested in writing about that it is hard to decide. I really like fiction and fantasy, so it might be that. It might be a retelling. I've written half of a retelling of Sefer Shmuel as a young adult novel, so I might just finish that. We'll see. I have a lot of things that I've started and not finished. So that I think that would be if I can get through the Parsha podcast, and if I can get that done, you know, all throughout, then I think probably the next thing would be some kind of book project, but I don't know yet what the book would be.
Okay. I kind of feel like Devin Bishafkin for anyone who listens to 1840. Like, if you had a great sum of money, what would you write your PhD about? Okay, Beth.
So the opposite of Olivia, my next project is, you know, she said she has a podcast and she's looking to write a book. So I have a book and I have this weekend launched a podcast. So in terms of like where I derive inspiration, a lot of times when I read really anything, I no longer just read with my hands, my eyes, and the book. You can ask my kids, like I have, you know, all those post-it sticky notes. I have them all over the house, so when I read, I really try to flag, you know, in the books, different sources of inspiration, beautiful prose, ideas I want to remember, because I found that, and I'm sure many of you have found this too, when you read, you love a book, or it inspires you, and then if someone asks you a month later about the book, maybe you can tell them the thesis, right? But it's hard to remember those things that you're like, oh, this is so life-changing, right? So I flag those pieces in the book, and then I transfer them afterwards to like a main document I have. It's almost like cliff notes on inspiration. And one of my daughters actually helps me transcribe. She'll read the stuff, and then I'll try. And it's really beautiful to see, like, you know, what speaks to her and what doesn't. But I've been doing this for years, and I've been collecting these ideas. And I decided, a few people, you know, had mentioned to me recently how, you know, they wanted more content for me, you know, maybe some deeper things about the book, but in general, so I felt like this would be a great opportunity to launch the podcast. It's called Ideas That Change Lives, and each episode has a life-changing idea, either that changed my life or the person I'm interviewing. The first episode is up, and then the second one will hopefully be up in the next few days, so look out for it, Ideas That Change Lives. And my goal is to not just, you know, keep the ideas for myself. There's a beautiful quote by a writer I was recently introduced to that's, you know, full of insight. Her name is Pema Chodron. And she says that when you take a drop of water and you put it on a rock, it dries up in the sun. But when you take a drop of water, and you put it in the ocean, it's there forever. So I really feel like part of my goal in everything I do is to not just keep my ideas to myself, but to try to, you know, influence as many people as possible. Another thing I do in my articles is I feel like there needs to be more authenticity in our worlds, right? Authenticity needs to trump perfection. Social media has sort of made us all try to put these perfect images of ourselves out there. But really what we need is people to be real with us and willing to be vulnerable. And a lot of my articles for the Jewish magazines, like Mishpacha, for example, and you can read my articles online. You can go to BethPerkel.com if you want to see some of them. I really do mostly personal essays about things in my life. So some examples are, I wrote an article about how in my 30s I was diagnosed with hypertension. And, you know, it's called the silent killer because most people don't know they have high blood pressure. So I sort of self-diagnosed it. I figured it out on my own. So it was really an educational article, you know, helping women, you know, look out for the signs themselves and figure things out. I was sort of getting a bit frustrated by some of the materialism I was seeing that sort of made the norm in our society. Especially there's a lot of people that can't afford, you know, the levels of some of these materialism. So I wrote an article that weaved in, actually, my son's bar mitzvah. It's a really beautiful story if you want to read it. But I told the secret of my engagement ring, the story of how my husband and I, when we first got married, we wanted to go to Israel for our Shana Rishona, and he wanted to learn there, but we really didn't have the money to do it. So instead of me getting a diamond engagement ring, we went to shop at Kmart, and I got a cubic zirconia, and we used that money to go to Israel. So I had a lot of people write into me after that article to say, like, you know, how much they appreciated that, and sharing that story, and, you know, normalizing sort of the other side of things. And then probably my most impactful article that really got the most responses from people was before Corona hit, so right before January 2020, I had a very difficult high-risk pregnancy that started off as triplets. By the second trimester, it was twins, and then I lost the pregnancy. So I wrote an article about that because although miscarriage is talked about more nowadays, it's still something that most people suffer with on their own, and there was really a tremendous response that people wrote in. That's probably the most fan mail I've ever gotten, of people saying how the article helped them not only then, but in the years after. You know, a lot of people in the community have turned to me when they're experiencing something because they know I've been public about that, so I've sort of developed like a chizuk packet that I've given people who reach out to me to give to their friend who's going through it. And people have even said when they read the article at the time, you know, they had never experienced a miscarriage, and so they, you know, it was really impactful to read, but they couldn't relate. And then years later, when they did experience it, they went back to the article, and it really helped them. So, you know, Horizons on the Future are also, you know, just sharing more, you know, of my life experiences and trying to help people. I do have some books that I also am trying to now publish as second books. I have a children's book. I have a fiction book, also young adult fiction. We should talk. So those are some of my irons in the fire right now.
And Alyssa, what's next?
Okay, so I'm currently working on a doctorate at Arts Israeli, YU's Graduate School for Jewish Education, with an emphasis on leadership and innovation. So this past summer, I was preparing a new course. I just started teaching modern Jewish history at Ida Crown as well, focusing on teaching Holocaust and Israel. And so being immersed in the Holocaust literature just directed my interest towards studying more about how the Holocaust is being taught in America, in Europe, not just in the Jewish setting, but also in public school settings. It's one of like the mandated required history curricula in, I think, close to 31 states now in America. It's mandated in a lot of countries in Europe. So right now for my doctoral work, I'm looking at what is really the teacher-educator goal in teaching Holocaust curricula? And it looks like we're moving more and more, teachers are moving more and more away from just the history of the Holocaust to what lessons can we extract from learning about the Holocaust. Learn lessons like anti-bullying, anti-racism, but what the danger is in that I'm starting to see in some of the literature, is we're moving so much away from the Holocaust that students are graduating from programs where they technically had a Holocaust curriculum and knowing almost no facts about the Holocaust. So even when we go into spaces in student-to-student, we do an exit survey after every presentation. And so some of the students said, like, wow, I had never heard of the Holocaust before, because we do touch on the Holocaust in our presentation. Or I knew about the Holocaust, but I didn't realize 6 million Jews were murdered during the Holocaust. There was a recent study that was published that said close to 60% of millennials either had never heard of the Holocaust or didn't know the extent of the Holocaust. So it's... when you say we're going to teach lessons from the Holocaust, everyone's like, of course, let's teach all the lessons from the Holocaust. But then it becomes a discussion of, well, whose lessons? Which lessons? And so I'm just finding that field of the literature to be really, really fascinating. And there has been an assumption that if you teach students about the Holocaust, they will, by default, intuitively become less racist and less anti-Semitic. And the quantitative studies that actually measure that are not finding that to be the case. That in classrooms where teachers really lay a solid foundation of like civic mindedness, global awareness, anti-prejudice education in general, then those students are reporting lower rates of bullying, anti-Semitism, anti-racism. But teaching the Holocaust alone is not teaching people to be less anti-Semitic. So I guess my next step in looking into this literature is, if Holocaust education isn't the best education to combat anti-Semitism, then what is? Or if Holocaust education is, Holocaust education how? Because it's not directly doing that just by default. So that's sort of the next steps of where I'm looking into kind of bridging the different worlds that I'm in terms of being an educator, teaching Jewish history, and the student-to-student piece.
Thank you. Okay, with that, I want to open it up if anyone from the crowd. Yeah, we have a question.
At Ida Crown, do they have a connection with the Tikva Academy?
Do you know?
Tikva Scholars?
Tikva Scholars. I mean,
yeah. So
what's... Yeah.
Are you talking about the Tikva Scholars program at Princeton and Yale? Yeah,
no,
so...
we have for high school students, too.
Right, right. So the one that I know about, I don't know if this is the one you're referring to, is that students can spend a summer, and they can spend, like, they could do summer courses.
Because for the high school students, my grandson in New York, they have for on Zoom for 9th and 10th grade.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, so I'm aware of the Zoom option as well. So it exists, and we've told students about it, but at the end of the day, it would be a supplementary, like, it wouldn't be instead of a course that's being taught at Ida Crown, but it's something that if a student were interested, people would be happy to write them letters of recommendation and have them sign up. So our students are definitely aware that TIFBA Scholars is a program or an option that exists along with lots of other programs.
Maybe you want to explain, just tell the audience what it is.
Oh, what it is. Well, there's a couple of different branches to what TIFBA is doing. But if any of you guys have heard of the Bronfman Fellowship, which is a pluralistic program that takes 26 students from North America to Israel and teaches them and so on, so many of the students who might apply to a Bronfman program would also apply for a TIFBA Scholars program, in that TIFBA Scholars is focusing on great ideas in Western literature and philosophy or classics, and then how does that work in terms of Judaism or having conversations about, let's say, Zionism and Judaism, and it offers courses on Zoom, and it also offers summer seminars, usually at places like Yale and Princeton. We've had students who have done the summer seminars in the past.
And
yes.
You know, being a member of Dilly and listening to you on Zoom and all you ladies, and I hear that you have all these creative, brilliant ladies. Where do you see the future as far as the female, you know, a woman getting perspective on the Torah and Parsha and even in the Halakha? Do you see women coming out and writing books? I mean, maybe, let's say, to compete against very knowledgeable, I'm not saying compete in a bad way, but, you know, because the Torah, there's so much we still don't know, and we're more knowledgeable and more knowledgeable, and there's a perspective that we women might have that nobody ever thought of before, just because of who we are. So I'm just wondering, where do you see going in the future? I guess it's a question for all of you.
So there is actually a scholar, more of like a grant. I think it's given through Nishma, is it from Matan? It's basically a one-year grant for women to write a book and write a sefer, essentially. So I saw this come out last year, and so I think there are more programs and grants, and you know, if that's any indication of the future, then there's definitely an interest in empowering women and funding women to develop projects like that. And that's just one example that I've seen.
Yeah, I think we're going in a good direction with that. There are now, Yoatzot Halacha, which are women who are very knowledgeable in all the laws having to do with Taharat HaMishpacha, which is the female purity laws. You may have encountered or met someone who's a Yoatzet Halacha, and even if you haven't met one in person, there's a lot being done in Instagram, actually. This is a very interesting use of social media. Social media as a space where women are able to disseminate knowledge and share information, whether it's because of their professional degrees as therapists or whether it's because they're a Yoatzet Halacha or they got some other kind of degree. So I think there's the degreed programs there's making more progress. There's also an interesting duality between what's going on in Israel and what's going on in the United States, in that in Israel we have many women who have like the title of Rabbanit or who are doing high-level learning. I got to do a really cool program with something called the Matan Bellows Eshkolot program. So it's out of Matan in Israel, and it was on Zoom every Sunday from either 9 to 3 or 9 to 1, and it's actually really exciting. I'm going to go meet up with a whole cohort of people from across the country, including people in Israel who are learning in Matan in a few weeks, and we're all going to learn together in Israel at the Matan Beit Midrash, which is awesome. There's something called the Orthodox Leadership Project, which is very focused on empowering women and their visions for the Orthodox community. So if you Google that, Orthodox Leadership Project, if any of you are interested, they're actually accepting applications until January 5th. So that's something that if any of you want to do, you can go do that now. So I think it's very positive, and I agree with you. I think that women do have perspectives on Torah and on Tanakh that are different because there might just be certain experiences that women go through or that women have. Like, you know, you were talking before about how you were able to empower so many people because you were able to share your story of pregnancy loss. And, you know, there's a whole organization now called I Was Supposed to Have a Baby, which is very active on Instagram, also active in other spaces, that is aiming to support women and started and founded by a woman. And I think when women read certain segments of Tanakh or of Gemara or of anything in our tradition through the lens of the experiences that they have, they bring something different to it that can deepen people's learning and people's connection to that story or to that experience in a way that's simply different from how someone who is not a woman might. So I think we're living in a really exciting time, and I think that there are a lot of opportunities that are beginning to pop up, and I hope that there will be more.
Yeah, I agree. I think that we're seeing a lot of new opportunities, and it's becoming more normalized as well. It's less like, oh, wow, there's a woman in this role. I would also say, like, in my own continuing growth as a student of Tanakh, like, one of the first writers that I often pick up to look at, well, what does Dr. Erica Brown say about this sefer that I'm now teaching in my Tanakh class? And she's also the head of the Rabbi Sachs legacy program through YU and the head of a fellowship program that just started. Nechama Price, who's actually in my cohort at Israeli, in the doctoral cohort. So she's the head of the GPATS program at Yeshiva University. They're starting a Tanakh track, or they already launched a Tanakh track as well. So I think that we are seeing, first of all, we're seeing a demand for it among young Jewish women who want to grow and advance in a serious professional way in Jewish education in the world. And we're seeing all sorts of organizations meeting that demand as well. What else?
Just to interject, not to take away from the panelists, but I also think, like, in my role at Neely, I get to field a lot of people's, like, questions and requests for educational opportunities, and I get to also hear a lot about what's going on other places in the country in terms of women's education, and I think we are now at a place in Torah education where people expect there to be a woman's voice present, that it's no longer expected to be the norm and not necessarily what people always want, that it should be men teaching women. Like, I will often get requests, like, we want this type of shiur, this time of day, oh, and we want a woman. And I'm like, and I want a unicorn. but the reality is that people are really, that has become the expectation, that we expect that there are so many learning opportunities for women, and we also want those educational spaces for women, that we want to be able to hear and learn from women, because like you said, the experience is different, that people want to be able to learn from other women because it's relatable, it's understandable. And I think it's because it's the expectation, it's sort of like a cyclical process, that we create the opportunities to learn, so then we create the opportunities to educate, and it goes around. People want it, so we have to provide it. Yeah, we're going to end with our last question.
Me?
Yeah.
Wow, thank you. I feel special. Okay. I hope it's good enough to end it all. So one of my favorite scholars is Nechama Leibowitz. She is fantastic. Not that some of your name is Nechama, but I love her points. I don't find that there are many female Parshans, like, specifically. And are there modern ones coming out who I can support, who are knowledgeable, who... I don't know of any other woman who's on Sfaria the Parshan. And that is Chabad. But also, maybe I'm wrong.
So I think there are some, but English speaking or English language writing is where I think we have the dearth of them. Like, I think there are some Hebrew books and Hebrew scholars being put out, especially if you contact the people at Matan. So Dr. Yael Ziegler and Rabbanit Shani Terrigan, they would be able to direct you to many, like, I think, female authored. I don't know if it would be on every single pasuk in the way that, like, typical Parshanut might be. I hear that that's what you want. Yeah, I hear that that's what you
want. Sorry, I don't know. No, yeah. It's not like I don't want English. It's just that's very nice. I want, like the,
I understand that.
I want the text-based stuff, you know?
Yeah. So there are some. Dr. Yael Ziegler has put out a number of books that I highly recommend. She has one on Ruth and one on Lamentations that are just... It's brilliant stuff. And then the other person to read is her name Aviva Zornberg?
Yeah.
I think it's Aviva Gottlieb Zornberg. So she has books on, for sure, all the Parshiot. And I really enjoy her because she also brings all of her knowledge of English literature to her explanations of the Parsha, which are often very deep psychological portraits. So if you like Ramban, you're going to like Aviva Zornberg.
What about you like the Nitziv?
Do I like the Nesiv? I do.
No. I'm saying, I find that I really like Velaj and like Rav Chos. I'm so sorry.
Yeah, go ahead. No, so anyway, I think there are. There might be some more who are writing Hebrew Sfarim. There are some English language, but I agree. I think that there's more opportunity for women to write Parshanut or to come up with Parshanut.
And also, I don't want to be radical. Like, I'm not trying to be this crazy thing. I just love Torah, and if I have ideas, why can't I write them down and have my own?
So I think the grant I was talking about is specifically to develop that.
I think
it's through Matan.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Then you should do it.
We're going to wrap up.
Oh, sorry.
Nope, not at all. Okay, thank you so much, everyone, for joining. I just want to mention thank you to Mrs. Margaret Matenke for sponsoring today's panel, and thank you to all the other sponsors who sponsored the programming today, and thank you to everyone who attended. It was really